This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله.
Assalamu alaikum. Hope everyone is doing well. Today we will be discussing Indo-Pakistan or Islamic India, the history thereof, current trends, religious movements, and so on. And we have with us as a distinguished expert in the field, Ustaz Adnan Rashid. How are you doing, brother?
Alhamdulillah. Thank you so much for having me. Allah bless you.
And you too. Now, I've taken this from your Twitter feed, right? So you're a historian, numismatist, traveler, human rights activist, author, supporter of peace and justice, and a bibliophile. So a nice eclectic mix of interest there. So let's just get right into it. I mean, we'll maybe start with something current before we get back into history, as it were. The reason for the West's discontent recently, anyway, is Afghanistan. Afghanistan captured everyone's attention with the Taliban takeover, and they generally or largely espouse a particular religious school, which is Indian in origin, right? They are obviously outside of South Asia, more Central Asia, a historic region of Khorasan, now known as Afghanistan, but they have adopted, to a greater or lesser extent, an Indian strand or Indian religious movement, which we know as Deobandism. And Deoband, of course, is a city or town located 1,000 miles east in northern India. So the first question would be, who or what is Deobandism?
Okay, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for that question. Deoband was a school that was established in India, in northern India, in Uttar Pradesh, in the province of Uttar Pradesh, which is the largest province of India currently, in terms of population, at least. And this was a small village called Deoband near the city of Saharanpur. Saharanpur is a very well-known city in India, and Deoband was in close vicinity. So Deoband, as a school for the Hanafi school of thought, the scholars got together. They saw the need that they need to establish a school to educate the masses, because the masses were very ignorant about Islam and Islamic sciences. And that was causing many, many problems. In fact, one of the reasons why this school was established was that there was an independence movement going on. And a lot of people, a lot of local people misunderstood the Islamic rulings on the matter of independence and resisting occupation, and even struggling for independence and how to do it, who leads it.
And independence from the British, sorry, right? From the British?
Exactly. Right. Independence from the British rule in India, because the British were ruling at the time. And this school was established, if I'm not mistaken, in 1863 by a group of scholars who came from the Hanafi school of thought. And they had studied under the students of Shah Waliullah Ad-Dehlavi. For example, Shah Abdulaziz Ad-Dehlavi's grandson. They were students of Shah Abdulaziz's grandson. So this is a very interesting side of Indian Islam, which not many people know, that prior to 1850, I would say, the school of Deoband did not exist. The Bareilvi school of thought did not exist, at least by name, right? And the school of Ahlul Hadith was not pronounced. It wasn't announced as a school of thought. So before 1850, Muslims were simply Muslims without specifically prescribing to one school of thought. So Deoband was established after 1850s, which was in 1863. Even the school of Ahlul Hadith was announced later on in the latter half of the 19th century, when scholars like Nawab Siddiq Hasan Khan, scholars like Sheikh Nazir Hussain Ad-Dehlavi, and there were other scholars like Sheikh Hussain bin Mohsen Al-Ansari Al-Yamani, who had come from Yemen to teach Hadith in Bhopal. Scholars like these, they started to express their following of a let's say, new school of thought in India, if you want to call it that. It wasn't a new school of thought. Of course, inspiration came from people like Imam Shawkani, and before that, Ibn Taymiyyah. And, of course, Ibn Taymiyyah claimed his descent, spiritual descent from the Salaf, right? So the school, the thought is not new. But in India, as a group of people, as an organized school of thought, this was the initial stage, right? Latter half of the 19th century. Many people claim Shah Waliullah had already expressed views supporting the Ahlul Hadith school, and his grandson, Shah Ismail Shaheed, was also of that view. But it wasn't really announced publicly that there is a new school in India of Islam now called Ahlul Hadith. Having said that, coming back to Deoband, so Deoband school of thought was established to educate the masses. And it is said that the madrasa initially was put together under a tree. There was a tree in Deoband, in the village of Deoband, and teachers started to teach the students under that tree. And then the tree basically became the central point of Islamic learning. And then it grew in magnitude, in all forms, on all levels. And then a building was established, and slowly and steadily it became an institution of higher learning. Today, Deoband is a huge university in India, and it sent out scholars for the last 100 years and so to different parts of the world, in particular Pakistan and Bangladesh, because scholars, when they qualified from the school, they spread out in places like Bangladesh, Pakistan, even as far as South Africa. So these scholars then established their own seminaries in their respective areas, and then many students flocked to these seminaries, and they took back the same school of thought or same way of thinking, or let's say same madhab with them to their areas. So with regards to what's happening in Afghanistan, these people called Taliban, they actually, a lot of them studied in Pakistan, in Pakistani seminaries that prescribed to their one school of thought.
So, I mean, that's peculiar in the sense that the direction of travel of Islam generally in the subcontinent has been the opposite direction, right? From Afghanistan through the various passes, Khyber Pass, Gomal, Bolan Pass, etc., in what the British called anyway, NWFP, Northwest Frontier Province, or not. I think it's got a newer name, like Pakhtun Wala or something, province or something. So it was always like west to east in terms of post-Umayyad, we'll get to them soon enough. So how is it that in this case with the Deobandism, it went east to west? Why would they, let's say, a largely Pakhtun, let alone, well, this is largely Pashtun, right? The Pashtuns of Afghanistan. Why would they adopt Islam from those who maybe psychologically they consider to be the recipients of their learning, as opposed to the other way around?
You see, one of the biggest reasons is conflict. During the war, the Afghan war, institutions had been destroyed. There were a lot of immigrants to Pakistan from Afghanistan. And due to the war, it wasn't possible to run institutions and educate students. So a lot of muhajireen in Pakistan, immigrants or migrants in Pakistan, they had no choice but to send their children to schools. Now, they couldn't send their children to private schools or expensive schools or even government schools because of their refugee status. They started to send their schools to these madaris that readily basically took these students into their arms and educated them, and they ran into thousands. So the number of students studying in Pakistani institutions run by the Deobandi school of thought, or Deobandi scholars who were directly inspired by Deobandi scholars from India, there is no direct link between the Afghan refugees and the Afghan students of the school of Deoband and the school of Deoband in India. There is no direct link, because these immigrants were not allowed to go to India to study. So they remained in Pakistan, and they studied in institutions like Haqqani institution called, Haqqaniya. It is named after a person who was a sheikh, and he established this institution called Haqqaniya in Akola Khatak, Kora Khatak is a place near Peshawar in Pakistan, and this is where these Afghan students were studying. And later on, they went back to Afghanistan and launched their own movement to liberate Afghanistan from warlords and so and so. So this is the recent reason as to why knowledge traveled westwards rather than it coming eastwards. Initially, in the early stages of Islam in India, of course, there were hardly any Muslims in India. So many scholars actually came from the Central Asian region.
Right.
Now, not many people know this, that India initially was taken by the Arabs, of course, from the southern territory called Sindh and South Punjab. So many Arabs had made inroads into the Sindh territory of Pakistan and then southern Punjab as far as Multan. So many Arab dynasties were established at that time. Now, first the Umayyads, then the Abbasids came, and then after the Abbasids, the Ismailis appeared somehow, and then the Ghaznavids from the north invaded to basically do away with the Ismailis. So this is very dynamic history. So initially when the Arabs brought Islam with them, they brought their own version of Islam. In fact, some scholars state that the first school of thought to have been established in the Indian subcontinent was the Zahiri school of thought in a city called Mansura. Mansura was in Sindh, current-day Pakistan, somewhere near Karachi. The exact site is currently, unfortunately, unknown. There are some estimates, there are some opinions that such and such site may be Mansura, but Mansura, the city of Mansura, has been since lost. It was the capital of the Arabs in Sindh, and the first school of thought that was established in, let's say, the Indian territory was the Zahiri school of thought, which is pretty much very similar to the Ahlul Hadith school of thought, right? And this is very much testified to by travelers who traveled to Mansura at that time, early travelers, and they had testified that people who live in Mansura or in these Arab cities of Sindh, they speak the Iraqi dialect of Arabic, and they are following the Zahiri school of thought. In other words, they were very close. Yeah, sorry.
Yes, I was going to say, yeah, you had in the early formative years or decades, let's say, of Islam in India, you had basically two Arabic-speaking principalities. Then you had Mansura, which was founded by, how should we describe it, a career rebel, Mansur bin Jamhur. And in Multan was also an Arab principality. And of course, they came with the Arab train, as you mentioned, the Bani Umayya, who were Athari anyway. And so Zahiriya is a kind of expression of that. Let's say it's a flavor, jurisprudential flavor of that, as opposed to a creedal. The creedal was, with the exception of Mansur bin Jamhur, the creed itself was what now, I guess, Ahlul Hadith would back project, right? And say, you know, yep, we're of the people of the Hadith. And then I guess that's what happens, right? When you have an like you have from Bani, the Umayyads go to the Abbasids, when you have that tumultuous, for want of a better term, revolution, then you tend not to be concerned so much with the periphery. You tend to want to consolidate the power base, which is obviously in Iraq or Syria to Iraq. So the ends kind of fly away. So obviously Spain became an independent Umayyad kingdom, and then India or Sindh kind of broke off. The Abbasids didn't really give it too much time. And as you said, the Qaramita, the Ismailis took over. And then you had, as you mentioned, we get into this now, I guess, more, you had a non-Arab adventurers coming from the north, the Ghaznavids, Indian Mamluks, Lodis and so on, and the Sultanates, all the way to the Mughals. So of course, this is something quite significantly different. Not only they're not Arabs, but also they don't share that one universal or global caliphate type of background, the kind of semi or independent or fully independent new empires. So give us a brief overview then of these post Umayyad, Turkic, Persian, Mongol, wherever they were, new dynasties, just as an overview, and then we can maybe get into more details.
Basically, I was explaining that first the Arabs came, and the Arabs ruled nearly for 300 years. And then the Arab rule declined, and the Ismailis had established a base in the city of Multan, which is in southern Punjab. And then Sultan Mahmud Ghaznavi who was the ruler of Ghazna in Afghanistan, he basically wanted to somehow conquer or completely decimate the Ismaili presence in India. And the inspiration definitely came from Baghdad, because the Caliph had already heard about Ismaili stronghold in India, like there was one in Yemen. And by this time, the Fatimids were also in power in Egypt. So the Ismailis were spreading all over the world with the Dawah. So Sultan Mahmud Ghaznavi basically decided to invade India, partly due to the Ismailis and partly to attack the temple of Somnath, because there was a lot of money there. There was a lot of gold there. A lot of people think that Mahmud Ghaznavi was after the destruction of the Hindu religion. He wasn't. He was simply interested in the money in that temple, like all kings would be. And this was an Indian phenomenon. Many Indian kings would invade territories, and the first thing they would do is to go to temple and loot the treasure. Right. So the treasure would be kept at the temple. That's why many scholars have highlighted, this is why mosques were not attacked, because there was no money kept in mosques, right? But in temples, there were vaults, there were, you know, basements full of gold and silver, basically offerings given by the devotees to the temple and to the idol. And those offerings were kept by the temple priests in a specific area within the temple. That's why temples were targets of aggression of different conquerors. So Mahmud Ghaznavi, basically, he took the treasure from the temple. Obviously, he was a king. He invaded territories to gain strength and influence. He was, by the way, his establishment was Shafi'i. Mahmud Ghaznavi and his establishment was Shafi'i, because he himself was a vessel of the Samanids. Samanids were a Central Asian dynasty representing the house of Abbas, Banu Abbas. It was an Abbasid dynasty in the 4th century of Islam. Their peak was in the 4th century of Islam, from 300 to 400s, right? Now, it was in the 300s, or within the 300s, when the Samanids started to lose their influence, and people like Alptagin, who was a slave vessel of the Samanids, he announced his independence or semi-independence, right? Then came Subuktagin, the father of Mahmud Ghaznavi, and then Mahmud. So Mahmud became a very ambitious man. He wanted to extend or expand his territory. By the way, up to this point, the Hindu dynasties were ruling up to Kabul. The land up to Kabul within the Indian territory, or let's say the Afghan territory, was occupied by an Indian dynasty, right? So it was Mahmud who ousted this dynasty and brought this dynasty back to Peshawar, and then drove this particular dynasty away from Peshawar. They were the names of the kings. I forgot the names of the kings. They're basically called Hindu Shahi. This dynasty is called Hindu Shahi dynasty. You can still find their coins lying around with the bull on one side and a knight on the horse on the other side. These are very common coins you can still find in this region. These are called the Hindu Shahi dirhams, right? So Mahmud Ghaznavi basically ousted the Hindu dynasty, Hindu Shahi dynasty, from this region. And then he made his way to Multan, and he conquered Multan. He established his foothold in Multan, and then he also established the first powerhouse of Islam in northern India, and that was Lahore, not Delhi. A lot of people think it was Delhi. No, it was Lahore. Lahore was named Mahmudpur, and many scholars flocked to Lahore, taught hadith, taught fiqh, and Lahore was essentially a Shafi'i hub. It was a Shafi'i city, right? So the Ghaznavids kept this city of Lahore for nearly, let's say, 200 years until the Ghurids defeated the Ghaznavids within Afghanistan, and all the territory within India also came to the Ghurids. And this is a very crude summary I'm giving to you very quickly, because there are far too many details. And there was a lot of back and forth of the cities as well. Cities were occupied and reoccupied and occupied and reoccupied. So the Ghaznavids and the Ghurids were at loggerheads, and then they eventually basically Ghaznavids kind of disappeared from the scene and Ghurids came to power. So Sultan Mu'izzuddin Muhammad bin Saab, Muhammad bin Sam, also known as Sultan Shihabuddin Ghori, was the man who took the city of Delhi or this territory from the Hindu ruler at the time, Prithvi Raj Chauhan, who was a Rajput ruler of this territory. So this territory was conquered from him as a result of the Battle of Tarain, which took place in 1192. This is at the same time when the Crusades are taking place in the Middle East, when Sultan Salahuddin Ayyubi is fighting the Crusaders, right? Sultan Shihabuddin Ghori or Muhammad bin Sam Ghori, he takes this territory in a second attempt. He had made many attempts. In fact, in the first Battle of Tarain, he was captured by this same ruler but released. And then he came back to fight again and he conquered this territory. And the city of Delhi was established. On his way back to Afghanistan, Sultan Mu'izzuddin Muhammad bin Sam Ghori was assassinated in his tent in the current day territory of Pakistan. And then one of his slaves called Qutbuddin Aibak came to power and he established a powerhouse in Delhi. This was the first establishment of an Islamic dynasty in northern India on this scale. And it only grew in power and influence due to the Mongol invasions. Now you may be thinking, how is that possible? What did the Mongols created the Indian civilization of Islam. A lot of people don't know this. It were the Mongols who basically, how can I put it? Mongols were the catalyst of what became the Delhi Sultanate.
Yeah, Genghis Khan, of course, famously chased the son of the Khwarazm Shah Muhammad across the Indus and decided he wouldn't give chase, and he was very much impressed with the bravery and the tenacity of that young prince. And the Mongols basically gave up all subsequent attempts. They maybe tried once or twice, but they thought, and this is something, you know, generally in terms of public perception, right, India is considered like a more submissive nation, let's say, compared to Arab and Turco-Mongol, certainly. Yet the Indians were able to defeat this juggernaut that had been trailblazing across the world and smashed so many of their empires. So that is quite a unique thing. I mean, other Muslims in the Volga region and elsewhere did, and of course famously the Mamluks did check the Mongols, but persistently and consistently it was the Indian Muslims who were real pain for them and would not allow them to expand. Although when it came to Timur, that's a different.
I would say this was mainly due to the leadership. The leadership was mainly Muslim, and of course there were Hindus also fighting alongside, but the leadership was mainly Muslim that fought the Mongols, and the Mongols were kept at bay. But the point I was making initially was the coming of the schools of thought. So with the Arabs initially came the Athari school, or let's say the Zahiri school, later on as it was called by some travelers. And then later on, the Shafi'i school came with the Ghaznavid establishment. So Lahore was a Shafi'i city, so was Multan. Okay, how did the Hanafi school of thought come to India is the question. So when when Qutbuddin Aibak took power, after him came another sultan called Iltutmish, Sultan Shamsuddin Iltutmish, who was also a slave, a Central Asian slave who had been bought from slave markets. And he became the Sultan, the king himself, right? So at this time, when Sultan Iltutmish was ruling, in 1219, Genghis Khan attacked the Khwarizm Shah territory, okay? And the details are far too long for me to discuss here, because I've done a lecture on the Mongol invasions. It's on my YouTube channel. You can watch it there. But to cut the long story short, Genghis Khan, his invasion caused a mass exodus of people. They basically started to leave their homelands for safety. Genghis Khan's army was massacring, pillaging, destroying, burning, decimating anything that came in their way. Even animals were not spared. Genghis Khan took very few slaves or very few prisoners of war. Rather, he would tell his army to terrorize the masses so that they cannot resist, or they don't even think of resisting. And for the next, 8 years, Genghis Khan went on a killing spree until he himself died in 1227. And then after him, his children, the Khans of the Mongols, they continued this onslaught, going as far as Syria and even Eastern European territory, even close to Western Europe, and as far as Japan. And India was attacked many times. Okay, even Genghis Khan himself pursued the son of Khwarizm Shah all the way up to the Indus River within the Indian territory. So this was a fascinating, episode in human history. But all of these Central Asian immigrants who were running for their lives, they took refuge in Delhi. Okay, they came to Afghanistan, and then Afghanistan was conquered by the Mongols, and then they were driven further southwards, and they found refuge in the city of Delhi. And that's why Delhi became a huge powerhouse of the Muslims. A lot of artists, a lot of scholars, a lot of calligraphers, a lot of hafiz, a lot of poets, a lot of intellectuals ended up. So basically, you can say the cream of the crop, the cream of the crop from Central Asia ended up in Delhi. So all of these people were Hanafi. Central Asian scholars were Hanafi since the Abbasid period, because Hanafi Qudat were established over them to run their affairs during the Abbasid period, because Banu Abbas had Hanafi scholars as their Qudat. For example, Qadi Abu Yusuf, who was one of the students of Imam Abu Hanifa, although Imam Abu Hanifa had refused to be the Qadi of Al-Mansur, but later on, Hanafi Qudat were established to run the affairs of societies in Central Asia and other territories. So people had since been Hanafi by persuasion. So a lot of these Hanafi scholars, the scholars of Mawrau Nahar, the scholars of Transoxonia, they were all predominantly Hanafi. So they brought the school of thought with them to Delhi. And lo and behold, we had the Hanafi school of thought established in India. And since then, India predominantly has been Hanafi, even though there are some pockets of Shafi school of thought in India, on the western coast, because a lot of these people were Yemenis originally. They were Yemeni travelers and traders, so they had brought Islam with them to the western coast of India, the coast of Malabar and all that, right? So this is, in a summary, how dynamic Islam was and Islam's story is in India, you know, when it comes to schools of thought, how schools of thought came to be established in the Indian subcontinent. And later on, of course, many movements came, you know, that challenged some of the tasawwuf of the Indians, and also the Hanafi school of thought. Some of the Hanafi views were challenged by the scholars of Hadith, and this continued. So the story of Islam in India is very dynamic when it comes to schools of thought.
Indeed. Let's get into some of the details of some of this. So in terms of Ahlul Hadith then, or the Ahlul Hadith movement, was it contiguous from the earliest times, since the Mansura, the principality, or since the time of Bani Umayyah and the Zahiris, or was it something a later import, as you mentioned, Shawkani and in his times in the Yemeni revivalist movement?
I would argue Ahlul Hadith, strictly speaking, not the title right. itself, but the reality of the Ahlul Hadith, what the Ahlul Hadith proclaim and what they claim to follow. What do they follow? They claim that they follow the Quran according to the faham of the earliest generations, right? And they follow the Sunnah according to the faham, according to the understanding of the earliest generations of Islam. And if this is what the reality of the Ahlul Hadith is, and it pretty much is, to my knowledge, then in that case, Ahlul Hadith, the school of Ahlul Hadith, the reality of it, not the name of it, the reality of it, is the first version of Islam to appear in the Indian subcontinent. It is the first version with the Arabs, because the Arabs were neither Shafi'i, nor Hanbali, nor Hanafi, nor Maliki. Okay? These Arabs who came to the Indian subcontinent with Muhammad bin Qasim, and later on with other Umayyad governors, they did not follow any of these schools of thought. So the question is, how were they praying? How were they praying? They were simply praying by looking at the example of the Sahaba, because they were very close to the time of the Sahaba. In fact, when Muhammad bin Qasim came to India in 92 Hijri, companions of the Prophet were alive. Actually, they were in Iraq, some of them.
Yeah.
Some of them were in Iraq. Anas bin Malik was in Iraq. Right? So I'm pretty sure when Muhammad bin Qasim might have left India for, left Iraq, Hajjaj bin Yusuf sent that particular expedition to India for whatever reason. Reasons are always disputed, and there are no authentic sources on the reasons, but there were some reasons for this invasion, whereby 5,000 men were sent with Muhammad bin Qasim to take some of the land of India, or possibly to teach some people a lesson. As some reports. Yeah, as some reports suggest, right? Some pirates who had hijacked a Muslim ship, and there were people there. So Hajjaj bin Yusuf sent this expedition to punish. I mean, these are some reports, but there is no way to authenticate them. So these first Muslims, when they came to Sindh with Muhammad bin Qasim, the question is, what version of Islam were they following when there was no school of thought around? You know, Imam Abu Hanifa rahmatullah alayhi, at the time was 12 years old. He was a 12 years old child. And Imam Malik would be 2 years old. Actually, no, Imam Malik isn't even born yet. Imam Malik was born in 94 Hijri. And Muhammad bin Qasim came to India in 92 Hijri. So the only Imam that was alive was Imam Abu Hanifa rahmatullah alayhi. He was 12 at the time. So what version of Islam were these people following? They were simply following Quran and Sunnah. You know, I'm going to put this in inverted commas. The Quran and the Sunnah, in other words, they were following whatever they had learned from the Sahaba. Clearly the Sahaba were alive. All the students of the Sahaba, the Tabi'een, the earliest generations of Islam. And this is what they were practicing in India, right? And they were not without knowledge. These people were very sharp, very, very intelligent enough to occupy a territory and run a government. How did they run this government? How were they running the daily affairs according to the rules of Islam? They were following the understanding of the Sahaba and the Tabi'een. Of course, they lacked some knowledge because Hadith literature had still not been collected. It was spread all over the Islamic Empire. There were muhaddiseen, or there were teachers who were teaching Hadith in Damascus, in Yemen, in other territories, for example. So I'm not saying these people were completely, fully educated in Islam. So that version of Islam is what the Ahlul Hadith school of thought proclaims today, with more information at their disposal. When I say more information, I mean Hadith literature was authenticated and collected later on in the second and the third century of Islam. Okay, and the Ahlul Hadith school today not only has that early knowledge, but even this later knowledge that was collected for them, for them to follow. So this is how Islam, I believe, came to India with that particular understanding. Later on, then, of course, schools of thought were established and they were spread, they were disseminated throughout the Muslim civilization. That's why the Ghaznavids were Shafi'i. Shafi school of thought is also very close to the so-called Salafi school of thought and the Ahlul Hadith, so Athari way of thinking, right? And then came the Hanafi school of thought, with the scholars of Mawra al-Nahar, or the scholars of Central Asia, who had immigrated to India due to the Mongol invasions. So this is the chronology.
I mean, I don't think any reasonable person will dispute the fact that right up until, who is it, Yazid bin Walid the 13th of 12th, maybe 12th Umayyad ruler, you had creed throughout the then universal Islamic empire, and only then you had other things, Qadriya, Mu'tazila, and then it returned to Athariyat somewhere. But the question is, since that establishment in Sindh, in India, of that archetypal Islam, and then you have the movement, let's say, of Ahlul Hadith, organization today, is there a link in terms of scholarship, or is it, my question, is there a link between that earliest entry of Islam and today's quote-unquote, pure Quran and Sunnah understanding, non-muqallid, ghair-muqallid understanding, or is this something that was later rediscovered?
It was rediscovered later on. There is no continuous link between the early Arab Islam that was brought to the Indian subcontinent and what happened later on in the 19th century or the 18th century. There is no direct link. The inspiration for the later reawakening of the school of Ahlul Hadith, or the Asri creed in the Indian subcontinent came from the Hijaz region, not from the Arab legacy in Sindh.
Right.
The Arab
right.
legacy in Sindh was completely, how can I put it, lost, okay,
right.
for centuries. I mean, until a very long, up to, I mean, as late as, let's say, the 20th century, it wasn't even known which governors ruled the Arab Sindh.
Right.
Okay. Some of the names of the Umayyad governors only came to knowledge or came to light due to the coins that were discovered, right, in Sindh. So names would be on coins, right? And of course, there are brief references to these governors in books like Futuhul Buldan of Imam Baladuri and all that. You can find mention of these governors, but there would be no other way to verify that information. So coins were discovered. And on the coins, the names of these governors, such as Hakam bin Awana, for example, Tamim bin Zaid, okay, Suleiman bin Muhammad bin Qasim, sorry, Amr bin Muhammad bin Qasim, who was also a governor of Sindh for some time. He was the son of Muhammad bin Qasim during the Umayyad period. Their coins have been discovered, right? But there is no direct link between the Arabs, the early Arabs, spiritually or in terms of knowledge transmission, with the later Muslims in the 18th century and the 19th century who proclaimed the school of Ahl al-Hadith. So inspiration came this time in the 18th century and the 19th century directly from Hijaz and places like Yemen. From Hijaz, it was brought by Shah Waliullah Dehlavi. Of course, there was a study of Hadith. Throughout the history of India, you always had scholars of Hadith, even during the Mughal period and the Delhi Sultanate period. But they did not push the Athari school in India because the Hanafi school was well established, right? And the Hanafi school, the scholars from the Hanafi school would not allow another school to take, to take its place in within the Indian Muslim society, right? So later on in the 18th century, Shah Waliullah Dehlavi traveled to Hijaz. He studied with the scholars there. He studied Hadith, and he started to basically slowly drift away from some of the Hanafi opinions. And in other words, he became a semi-Hanafi scholar, not fully Hanafi. He started to basically highlight that certain opinions in the Hanafi school are controversial, to say the least, and they conflict with the Hadith directly. So he talked about, for example, the issue of Raf al-Yadain. He talked about that in his book, Hujjatullah al-Baligha, that Raf al-Yadain, the evidence for it is overwhelming. Likewise, his son then slowly drifted away further from the Hanafi school, the school of thought. Not entirely. They still refer to themselves as the Hanafi, as Hanafi scholars. They still taught Hanafi school, Hanafi fiqh in their seminaries, but they express their differences with the mainstream Hanafi school in opinions. So Shah Abdul Aziz, for example, when it comes to the issue of Fatiha Khalful Imam, he basically favored the Shafi school of thought because of the Hadith, La Salata Liman Lam Yaqra Bi Fatihat Al-Kitab, Bi Fatihat Al-Kitab, right? So then in the 19th century, some scholars, they expressed their distance from the Hanafi school openly, proclaiming some sort of Ahl al-Hadith way of thinking. You know, I'm saying inverted commas.
Right.
These were, you can call them proto-Ahl al-Hadith. Proto-Ahl al-Hadith in the Indian subcontinent in the first half of the 19th century. Who were these people? People like Shah Ismail Shaheed, who was the grandson of Shah Waliullah, who had become Ahl al-Hadith in his belief and practice. He spoke against the bid'ah and the shirk of some of the people of the tasawwuf. Not all the people of the tasawwuf were practicing these things, to be very, very clear, in case people are offended. But there was tasawwuf. There was a type of tasawwuf in India which was practiced, which constituted shirk and bid'ah. Okay, and
Could I just get into that a bit then? On the issue of tasawwuf, there's a character who comes to mind, Ahmed Sirindi, who is even before many of these died in the early 17th century. And he kind of popularized this transition from a very, monist pantheistic Wahdat al-Wujud to what he called Wahdat al-Shuhud. Wahdat al-Wujud we understand to be extreme form of shirk, in that saying that God, Allah, indwells within creation and that the creation of Allah is one, hence the term Wahdat in one. What did he, and it said that he was kind of on this kind of road himself, whether he got to where he intended to or not, we're not sure, or is this where he wanted to go to and he stopped. But if there was this kind of movement away, what some academics would call sober Sufism, right? Away from the crazy, extreme, fanatical, open, unorthodox heresy to something which is more in accordance with, in a broad sense, Sunni Islam. Could you speak to that about something?
Absolutely. You know, Sheikh Ahmed Sarhindi, also known as Mujaddid Al-Thani, or the reviver of the second millennium, right? Because the first millennium had already ended in the time of Emperor Akbar when he was ruling India. And Akbar had announced basically his apostasy from Islam in not so many words. He started to drift away into other ways of life, other systems. He initiated his own mystical order called Deen-e-Ilahi, although scholars argue that it was not a new religion, but a mystical order. It was like a mystical order in the Sufi sense, rather,
right.
Rather than a religion, right? So that is another discussion. But the point is, there was a lot of, let's say, ilhad or heresy or unorthodox thought going around in India at the time, because the emperor himself was suffering from such, conditions, such problems. So that's why it was necessary for some scholars to rise to the task and confront this rise of ilhad. So Sheikh Ahmed Sarhindi, to give him credit where it's due, he did stand up to it, and he challenged a lot of these kufri thoughts or disbelieving thoughts proposed as Islam, and even a lot of bid'ah and shirk within tasawwuf. He challenged it. He challenged the pantheistic school of Wahdatul Wujud directly head on, and he proposed another theory, because Wahdatul Wujud is a Neoplatonic theory which was pioneered by Muhyiddin Ibn al-Arabi from Spain, and then it was spread throughout Central Asia, and from Central Asia it was brought to India by the Central Asian scholars, and then it became the norm in India. And it was very much anti-Islam. This theory was directly against the concept of Tawheed, Allah's uniqueness. So this is why Sheikh Ahmed Sarhindi, in fact, some scholars even go as far as to argue that the concept was misunderstood. It does appear to be shirk, but it wasn't actually shirk, you know. So the spirit of it wasn't shirk, but it does appear to be shirk. So that's why a lot of scholars try to justify it or try to explain it away. Even people like Shah Waliullah, later on, he was of the opinion that the concept of Wahdatul Wujud was actually misunderstood by many people in India. Therefore, it needs to be re-explained or revised or something like that, right? But Shah Waliullah was a huge fan of Sheikh Ahmed Sarhindi for the right reasons, because Sheikh Ahmed Sarhindi stood against this onslaught of kufr and shirk and bid'ah at a time when it was becoming the norm. And then he was imprisoned in the time of Jahangir for his political activity. He wrote many letters to political influentials, people within the court of Jahangir, and even some of the courtiers of Akbar. He wrote letters to influentials to basically guide them to the right path as he saw it, Basically, it wasn't entirely what the Ahlul Hadith believe in today. So by our standard, even that wasn't the right path. And it is unfair to expect a Salafi, Athari, upright scholar from Sheikh Ahmed Sarhindi, when he himself was born in circumstances that didn't give him the chance to study the Athari school or even know about it. Okay, right. These beliefs were not even known in India at the time. They were not even understood. So to expect a strictly Athari understanding from people like Shah Waliullah and Sheikh Ahmed Sarhindi is anachronism. It is not fair. It is not fair. Like later Ahlul Hadith scholars, some of the Ahlul Hadith scholars from Pakistan lately have been condemning some of the writings of Shah Waliullah and Sheikh Ahmed Sarhindi and expecting them to be anachronistically to be just like them. This is not fair. You can't expect a scholar in the Indian subcontinent in the 16th century to be just like you, because what you learned in your seminaries or the knowledge you were given was pioneered in a long time. It took almost a century. The entire 19th century scholars spent to establish this curriculum for you, this understanding, and to revive it for you in the Indian subcontinent, for you to have it today. You know, you can't just have knowledge coming from vacuum. It doesn't appear like that.
Not to mention, print media wasn't, you know, proliferated at the time. So how would you get hold of a library? You know, and it costs money. You'd have to copy someone else's texts, and someone would have to explain it to you. There's so many, I don't want to say barriers to learning, but the circumstances, as you rightly mentioned, were just so different back then that it's asking so much, and almost, a kind of ingratitude, you know, to where we are now, off the back of the hard work in extremely difficult and dangerous circumstances, right? I mean, you could be lynched if the holy man thinks you're taken away from his livelihood or his religious interpretation.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we have to appreciate the sacrifices and the hard work of people like Sheikh Ahmad Sarhindi and his letters. If you read his letters, I mean, look, put aside his erroneous beliefs and ideas. I mean, he was not a fully orthodox scholar in our current understanding of Islam. Okay, right. According to our, you know, what we call the Athari, the Ahlul Hadith understanding of Islam, strictly speaking, for our school. Okay, I am myself Ahlul Hadith. I prescribe to the school of thought. Right. If I was to use my Ahlul Hadith standard of today to judge Ahmad Sarhindi, he would be an unorthodox thinker. He's not fully orthodox. But at the same time, you have to understand him in his own circumstances, in his own period. Was he even aware of this knowledge? Did he even have access to it? Did he have access? You know, Fathul Bari, by the way, Fathul Bari, the Sharh of Sahih al-Bukhari by Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani, it was only made available in India in the 19th century. Knowledge was lacking in those days. People didn't have access to most books. Very few people had access to knowledge, and even fewer had access to classical works of people like Ibn Taymiyyah, Ibn Qayyim, and even scholars before them, you know. So books were very highly valuable. Most books you found in India at this time were the Hanafi texts like Al-Hidayah, okay, and texts like, the Aqaid of Imam Maturidi and things like that. So people were taught strictly on the Hanafi school of thought, and they didn't have chance to study other sciences and other schools. So that's why the struggles of Sheikh Ahmad Sarhindi and Shah Waliullah and scholars like them have to be appreciated, despite the fact that we disagree with some of the teachings immensely, no doubt. But we have to, because they were sincere. According to the knowledge they had, according to their circumstances, they stood up for Islam. They defended Islam as they saw fit, basically. And same with Shah Waliullah. Shah Waliullah did the same thing when he came back. It wasn't easy to tell people that some of your beliefs are wrong. Mm-hmm. What you're doing in India is complete shirk and kufr and bid'ah. What you're doing is not correct. In fact, there is a text attributed to Shah Waliullah. A lot of people deny that it was actually authored by Shah Waliullah. It's titled Al-Balagh al-Mubin basically is pretty much, a lot of it is taken, the inspiration is taken from Ibn Taymiyyah's work, Sirat al-Mustaqim. Ibn Taymiyyah has authored a book, Sirat al-Mustaqim, and Shah Waliullah had taken much inspiration in this book from Shaykh al-Islam Ibn Taymiyyah. And the book is a genius form of writing, you know, like Socrates and Plato. You know, there's a work of Plato where we have dialogues of Socrates. Socrates is talking to his students. I think it's called Symposium. Yeah, it's called Symposium, if I'm not mistaken, right? Similarly, in this book, Shah Waliullah, he is having a dialogue with another person who believes in basically going to graves and seeking blessings and, you know, doing all sorts of things on graves, right? Mm-hmm. So Shah Waliullah is having a dialogue with this person and answering his questions. He's posing questions and Shaulullah is answering. So it's a dialogue between two people. The book is titled Al-Balaghul Mubin. And many Barelvi scholars actually deny that this book was written by Shaulullah Dehlavi for obvious reasons, right? Because it goes against a lot of their practices and beliefs. So I think we have to appreciate a lot of the work they have done and not look at the errors and the mistakes due to their lack of knowledge in those respective fields. So we must give them the benefit of the doubt and pray for them that may Allah forgive the errors and give them Jannah for their struggles.
I mean, we had, in fact, a similar kind of movement. I've got a series on the Taymiyyah Turks where you had this kind of Hanafi revivalist return to Hadith, return to Sunnah, influenced by Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn al-Qayyim particularly. And considering the environment, like Mughal India, the Ottoman Empire was a strictly Kalam, Maturidi, as opposed to the Ashari, but still Kalam-based creed and strictly Hanafi. So they had to navigate as best they could. And they might not have got to where we would very, you know, lackadaisically want them to or expect them to in today's standards with our access to a whole bibliotheque at our fingertips. But considering, you know, the obstacles, they did an amazing lot of reformation, reforms and lasting, of course. And on that point, if we go back to India, it's said that in Aurangzeb's time, particularly or under his reign, there was a move away from the more, extreme mutasawwifas. Sometimes they say as the difference between Sufism and the mutasawwif is that the mutasawwif is an extreme version of Sufism. It goes well beyond the pale of what would even be, have any kind of rooted Islam. So it's said that under his reign, there was a move away from just the Sufi syncretic with the Hindu kind of belief practice towards a more orthodox Naqshbandi Sunnism. Not that if we look in some Naqshbandi practices like the Haqqanis in certain parts of the world, that's also a bit out there, but this seemed to be a bit more, as we said, sober, a bit more anti-bidah, a bit more pro-Sharia, not unlike Imam Shamil in Dagestan, very pro-Sharia, and to their understanding, they were anti-bidah. Do you have anti-innovation? What do you have to say about that?
Even this had started with Sheikh Ahmad Sarindi himself. He specifically mentioned this in his writing that we have to be Sharia compliant. Our tasawwuf has to be Sharia compliant, because what was happening in India, there were two parallel ways. One was the Sharia Islam and one was the so-called tasawwuf Islam, which wasn't Islam, right? Mm-hmm. Because that tasawwuf wasn't Sharia compliant. It was against the Sharia. It was against the basic teachings of Islam, some of the tasawwuf that was being practiced in India. Therefore, people like Sheikh Ahmad Sarindi had come to realize this, and they highlighted this in their writings, that we have to be Sharia compliant. Our tasawwuf has to fit within the norms of Islam. Otherwise, it is not Islam. So don't call it Islam, right? Likewise, Shah Waliullah did the same thing. Okay, and amazingly, you mentioned Taymiyyah influence on the Turks. Not many people know this. Ibn Taymiyyah's influences had arrived in India within his life, or maybe close to his life, just soon after his death. In fact, it is thought that some of the students of Shaykh al-Islam, Ibn Taymiyyah, they arrived in India soon after his death. This was the time of Muhammad bin Tughlaq. Muhammad bin Tughlaq was a very powerful Delhi Sultan, and he ruled from 1325 to 1351 for almost 25 to 26 years. And in his time, there were many debates in his court about the practices of the tasawwuf known in India, even Chishti tasawwuf, because Sheikh Nizamuddin Awliya was alive at the time. He was alive in the time of Muhammad bin Tughlaq. In fact, he died in 1325, Rahmatullah alayh, and his student, the poet, the famous poet Amir Khusro, also died 6 months later, and they were buried together in the same spot. And the place in Delhi today called Nizamuddin is that place where the Sheikh is buried, right? He was a Chishti Sufi, right? So he believed in Sama, you know, listening to... listening to poetry with musical instruments.
Yeah.
And this was one of his ways to attract the Hindus to Islam, because Hindus, they loved music. Music was part of Hindu DNA. It has been for thousands of years, let's say, right? So it's part of the religion, you know, and singing and dancing is part of the religion, the Hindu religion. So to attract them, this was one of the ways to bring them closer, right? But some scholars in the court of Muhammad bin Tughlaq were against this way of dawah. They said, this is not Islam. This is actually against Islam. And a debate took place, a famous debate took place in the court of Muhammad bin Tughlaq between the ulama and Sheikh Nizamuddin Awliya, right? So the ulama were saying that Sama is not from Islam. And this was clearly due to some of the influences that had come from Sheikh al-Islam ibn Taymiyyah into India. And Khaliq Ahmad Nizami is a scholar, an Indian scholar, who has written an article specifically on this, Ibn Taymiyyah's influences in India. Okay? And I strongly recommend that particular article. I'm pretty sure you can find it if you Google it. Khaliq Ahmad Nizami, Ibn Taymiyyah's influences in India, or something like that. I may be getting the title wrong, but Google that, and you will find it, inshallah. And he mentions in detail how some of the scholars and some of the thought influences had already made their way into India at the Delhi Sultanate period. So there is no doubt that these influences were coming in, people from outside who had studied with the Middle Eastern scholars or scholars in the Mashq people like Ibn Taymiyyah. Don't get me wrong, even Ibn Taymiyyah believed in some form of the tasawwuf, not I shouldn't call it tasawwuf. I should call it tazkiyatun nafs. You know, they were people of azkar. Ibn Taymiyyah was a people of dhikr. He was a people of awrad. You know, he would do a lot of wird, of a lot of du'as. And likewise, Ibn Qayyim, he also wrote books on some form of tasawwuf, which is Sharia compliant, of course.
Yes.
So tasawwuf is a controversial term because of some recent practices, unfortunately. The name
right.
Sufi has been tarnished by
right.
some of the practices of recent, you know, like the name Shia was tarnished by some of the beliefs of the Twelvers later on who
right.
were found in Kufa and Basra, because the term Shia wasn't as bad, as tarnished as it is today, unfortunately. And that's why, you know, unfortunately, in the Sunni circles, at least, yeah, the term Shia has become a derogatory term, right? It is, when you call someone Shia, you're not praising them, right? But in the time of, let's say, Muawiyah, and maybe even the second century of Islam, the term Shia wasn't as controversial as it is today. Likewise, the term Sufi has become tarnished and controversial because of some of non-Sharia or non-Islamic practices of some so-called Sufis, such as dancing, smoking ganja,
yes.
Not praying, not bathing, bowing to graves, and uttering absolute shirk, you know, absolute, open, clear shirk from their tongues. Okay, this, and they call themselves Sufis, right? So this kind of so-called tasawwuf has tarnished the original, the real, the Sharia-compliant tazkiyatun nafs type of tasawwuf, okay, which was practiced by most ulama in the past, okay, which is practiced by some Ahlul Hadith scholars today, right? So rolling a tasbih doesn't make you a Sufi, although
yeah.
people start calling you, they start calling you a Sufi, but this is a virtue, this is a beautiful thing. You're making the zikr of Allah, you're remembering Allah, you're making du'as, as long as those du'as are sunnah prescribed, right? You're fine. People might call you Sufi, you know, but you're not. Strictly speaking, you're following the Sharia. You're following the instructions of Allah and His Messenger. So this is the confusion that came about, unfortunately. And Ibn Taymiyyah's influences were found in India very early. Then later on, of course, they disappeared. And during the Mughal period, the Mughal emperors themselves gave a lot of importance to tombs. In fact, Akbar is known to have walked to the tomb of Sheikh Salimuddin Chishti. And when a son was born to him, he named him Salim because of this sheikh. You know, Jahangir, his name was Nuruddin Jahangir or Nuruddin Salim, right? His name was Salim. He was named after the sheikh from this tomb. So the Mughal emperors were very much in favor of tombs and going to tombs and visiting tombs and Mughal establishment. Even the family of Aurangzeb was into it. Even Aurangzeb Alamgir was into it himself, but he was a lot more Sharia compliant than his predecessors because he had a company. He had the company of the ulama. The ulama were very frequent in his court, and he had the advice of the ulama. So he didn't do all those things his predecessors were doing at the tombs. But alhamdulillah, Allah forgive him. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give him Jannah for all the hard work he did. Even Fatawa Alamgiriya, if you read some of the rulings therein, or some of the questions about grave, you know, going to tombs, going to mazar, how do we, so the protocols are put down. And it clearly states there that sajda to the qabr is not allowed, it's haram. Okay? So even Fatawa Alamgiriya, which was compiled by the scholars, and many of these scholars were actually mutasawwifin. They themselves were Sufis, right? But they put down these orthodox teachings of the Hanafi school of thought on these matters in Al-Fatawa Alamgiriya, also known as Al-Fatawa Al-Hindiya, right? Which was compiled by the orders of Emperor Aurangzeb, and many scholars took part in the compilation of this particular compendium, which is possibly the largest work of Hanafi jurisprudence in the world today.
Alhamdulillah, and as we come to an hour, that kind of helps us get back to where we began. Let's bring it up to speed in terms of, if you would permit me to delve into politics a bit. If we're looking at the lay of, okay, great. If we're looking at the lay of the land now, I saw a debate, by the way, that you had, I wouldn't call it a debate, let's say a lively discussion on the issue of where it came to the discuss the issue of partition, and that it's not a black and white issue of nationalism, and there's some benefit in the Muslims having their own secure state. And I believe, if I've got your side right, that you're arguing that look at what's happening in India today. Were it not for Pakistan being a separate entity, autonomous political setup, then God knows how much further some of this oppression could have reached. With that as a context, where do you see Islam politically now with this religious, with religion being so accessible, let's say, with orthodox understanding being so prevalent, and as we mentioned, at the touch of a fingertip, how can this potentially help to revitalize Islam? And is there a difference between the borders in terms of what Islam is practicing in India? And I'm not being dismissive of Bangladesh, it's just that it's easier because of the proximity of India and Pakistan being on one border, as opposed to what's happening in Pakistan. Of course, in Pakistan, you have a Islamist kind of leader, right? At the level of, you could say, Erdogan is in Imran Khan, you have a certainly Islamophilic leader. And then in India, you have a nationalist and Islamophobic setup, a ruler with the Modi there. So speak to that and tell us what you think can happen, what should happen, and where others can possibly influence.
I believe currently Islam is under siege in India, and Indian establishment, the current establishment, is openly, unashamedly Islamophobic. They don't even hide it, and they don't make any excuses for it, because they seem to have received the blessings from the international community to be Islamophobic, because they're not being condemned, they're not being questioned about it. Modi's flying around, having conferences, meeting global leaders, shaking hands with them, even hugging them, and they are openly, you know, welcoming him. Even though in India, there is a silent genocide taking place right now as we speak of the Muslims. So Islam is facing destruction in India. Okay. At the same time, the Muslims are waking up. There's no doubt the Muslims are realizing that something ought to be done. Otherwise, this will be an open genocide very soon. In fact, there is a journalist called CJ Worleyman. Is that what he's called? He's very active on Twitter and I think Facebook. I see some of his posts, and he said that India has already crossed the threshold irreversibly of, you know, different stages of genocide, when genocide is about to take place, stage one, stage two, stage three. So he believes that now the stage where the genocide is irreversible has already been reached in India. So maybe there might be a genocide in India of the Muslims very soon, because the signs have already appeared. Hindu mobs are openly destroying mosques. They are attacking Muslim households. They are killing Muslims. They're lynching. There are lynching mobs walking around. So the condition of the Muslims is very similar to the condition of Afro-Americans in the American South in the late 19th century and early 20th century, where lynch mobs could simply find a black man, accuse him of a crime, put him on the tree, hang him, lynch him, and then there would be popcorns. You know, people would be selling popcorns, yeah. And this would be a spectacle. This is actually happened. This happened historically, where people would gather around a tree where a black man would be lynched and popcorns would be sold. People would be buying popcorns, watching the spectacle, right? This is how things are in India for Muslims. And Islam is under siege. The BJP establishment is openly attacking Islam, using ignorant Hindu extremist ideologues to attack Islam in erroneous ways. They are making claims that when you hear those claims, that you just laugh at them. But it is very serious. What they're doing is very serious. No one's questioning them. The Indian media is backing all of this. So Muslims are facing an existential threat in India right now as we speak, right? Everyone knows it. The whole international community is aware of it. The Muslims around the world are aware of it, right? So the situation of Muslims in India is very, very dire. And the Muslim community internationally need to speak up for the Muslims of India, just like they are speaking up for the Uyghurs, just like they spoke up for the Rohingya not long ago. We need to speak up collectively for the Muslims of India. It's no longer about Kashmir anymore. Right. Kashmir is a very, of course, it's a very popular movement, globally speaking. It is discussed even in the UN, right? But the condition of the Muslims within India, forget about the institutions, let alone the institution. I mean, I don't know if you watched a recent interview between a Hindu right-wing interviewer and the head of Deoband. No, he's an elderly sheikh. He gave some very good answers, and he was being pressurized into accepting the Taliban are your product. You are the ones who gave birth to Taliban because they call themselves Deobandi, and Deobandi is here in India. Therefore, you are a terrorist establishment. This is what they were telling this old man. And he was saying, we have nothing to do with Taliban. Taliban never came here. We never went there. So there is no direct link between us and Taliban. They can claim spiritual descent from us, but we have nothing to do with them. So this is the kind of rhetoric that's being used in India against the Muslims, right? If it's not ISIS, it's Taliban. You are either an ISIS sympathizer or you are a Taliban sympathizer. And it's clear that the Indian Muslims have made, their distance from these organizations very, very clear. The Indian Muslims have made it very clear that we are neither sympathizers of ISIS or Taliban or any other political entity around the world, extremist or otherwise, right? We don't have anything to do with them because it's simply not possible for them to have some kind of political thought or political view in India. So they are facing a very difficult existential situation, and may Allah protect them. So it is not very possible today to launch new institutions or have a renaissance of Islam in India. It will only come about when Muslims have equal rights, when Muslims are free to establish their institutions, when Muslims are free to express their views, when Muslims are free to teach Islam and practice Islam. That's not the case currently in India. Even those institutions that exist today are under threat, under the threat of closure, under the threat of outright destruction. I wouldn't be surprised, God forbid, Allah forbid, I hope I am wrong, and my, you know, in Persian they say, khakam badahan, you know, may dust be in my mouth. I don't want to say this, right? But I wouldn't be surprised in near future, one of these institutions was raided by a mob of Hindu extremists, and they might, they might start killing the ulama therein, you know, and start killing the students, you know, because they've been so brainwashed by the hatred of the BJP and the government that they end up doing something stupid like this, right? So Muslims are in a very, very difficult situation. In Pakistan, it's a different situation. Unfortunately, the situation of Islamic movement in Pakistan is not very promising as well.
Really?
I don't want to be pessimistic. Yeah, absolutely. The ulama or the so-called scholars who are leading the religious movement in Pakistan, they are not very upright, unfortunately. I don't want to mention names, but I cannot point to one person and say that these people are. There are individuals, no doubt. I'm talking about institutions and right. schools of thought. Schools have simply failed to produce effective leadership, right? For whatever reason, whether the politics of the country doesn't allow it, or whether they are scared for their lives, or whether whatever the reasons are, I don't want to go into those reasons. But the schools, all the schools, have failed to produce effective leadership that can lead the Islamic element within the country intellectually, intelligently, even politically, right? So Islamic movement is very, very weak. How do I know that? Look at the major parties. Look at the major parties in the country, right? Who are the major parties? The biggest party in Pakistan is PMLN, Pakistan Muslim League, Nawaz Group, Nawaz Sharif's party. Then we have People's Party, right, which is a secular party, right? Then we have, what other parties do we have? MQM, which is a secular party, right?
Nawaz Sharif's one as well.
Sorry?
Tariq Insaf as well, the ruling party.
PTI. Of course, PTI was brought into power. Everyone knows that now. It's openly discussed that they wouldn't come to power on their own. They were put into power by the establishment. So this much is very, very clear. But then now there's another rising power, which is called the Tariq al-Labbaik. Okay. It is predominantly Barelvi, right? So, you know, the situation looks very grim. When it comes to orthodox, strictly speaking, Quran and Sunnah schools not coming forward and producing effective leadership. So at the same time, Allah will take care of His people. I'm sure Allah will bring about some solution to these problems. You never know, these Tariq al-Labbaik people might come around and find the way, inshallah. Who knows? Who knows? Once they get international exposure, a lot of these people, they end up in bid'ah and all stuff like that, is because they don't have international exposure. They have born into a little circle of scholars and maulvis, and that's all they know. This is the Islam they know. But when they have international exposure, they'll probably come to realize that Islam is far bigger than they initially thought.
Who knows, maybe it requires the fourth battle of Panipat. There seems to be a way to reset the situation in the Indian subcontinent, these battles.
I wouldn't like to say it. I don't like to talk about conflicts and wars and destructions. Whatever Allah brings about is up to Allah. But the situation of Muslims in India is very, very, very dire. It needs immediate international attention, because you have people like Yogi, this extremist, I would call him a terrorist, Hindu monk who is bent upon the destruction of the Muslims, and his actions are this. The only reason they're holding back is because of the opposition in India. Don't get me wrong, there are very good moral Hindus in India who don't want this to happen. They want India to be diverse. They want India to be multicultural. They want India to be colorful. Okay, but these. The other side, the right-wing extremist Hindus, the saffron Hindus, you know, the color saffron.
Yeah.
These guys, they want one India, and that is Hindu. Okay? And they even talk about reconversion of the Muslims, mass reconversion of the Muslims back to Hinduism. They call it ghar vapsi. They call it, the term they use it, ghar vapsi, coming back home, basically, in other words. That we will bring all these Muslims back home from Islam to Hinduism. And they are coming up with the propaganda ideas like love jihad. The Muslims do love jihad. In other words, they convert Hindu girls and get married to them, and we cannot allow that. So if any Muslim man is known to have married an ex-Hindu woman, he will be killed by a mob. He will be lynched. He will be simply lynched, and the police will not take action. No case will be filed. There are so many cases. They run into hundreds. They run into hundreds of cases in India. India is basically a hodgepodge of a bunch of extremists right now, politically speaking. Not the masses, of course. The politicians are spreading hate against the Muslims actively. They want Muslims to be either completely you know, they want Muslims to leave Islam completely, or just, you know, they're not even allowing Muslims to live silently. They don't even tolerate the silence of the Muslims. They are pursuing Muslims all over India now. So Muslims make 14%, according to estimates, official estimates. I'm pretty sure it's more than that, right? Of India. How are you gonna, you know, reconvert or bring all these people back home as you see it? How are you gonna do that? It's very difficult unless you commit a genocide against them. And this is what the current government is trying to do. It is trying to cause what happened on a smaller scale in 2001 or 2002 in Gujarat on a massive scale in India. You know, under Modi, there was a pogrom against Muslims of Gujarat whereby 3,000 Muslims were killed and thousands of others were injured. And Modi was acquitted by the Supreme Court of India. And now Modi is trying to do that on a wider scale, on a bigger scale throughout India. And we pray that Allah protects the Muslims of India.
I mean, and who knows, if they attempt this genocide through intellectual terrorism, through debate and discourse, it might, inshallah, backfire and blow up in their face, in that they will be dumbfounded by the proofs of Islam and the strength of Islam through the Quran, through the Seerah.
They are already, don't get me wrong, they are already dumbfounded. That's why they banned people like Zakir Naik. They don't want people like Zakir. Zakir Naik is one of the most peaceful persons you will find in the world, right? Right, they couldn't tolerate him because he was converting thousands of Hindus through his reasoning, through his da'wah. Thousands upon thousands were accepting Islam. Now, even accepting Islam is haram in India. If you accept Islam from Hinduism, you'll get killed. The Dalits, the lower caste, many of them were coming to Islam and they were being tortured and killed and lynched by Hindu mobs for doing so. So, India is the most Islamophobic nation, officially speaking, in the world today. That's India, amazing. India, politically speaking, I'm not talking about the people, the masses.
Right, of course. People in India. Of course.
I'm not talking about all those millions of people. I'm not brushing them all with the same brush. No, absolutely not. India is full of absolutely amazing, moral, ethical people, Hindus and otherwise. India is a beautiful place. It is a beautiful country, full of beautiful people. But there is one ugly bunch which is currently, ruling India, is causing a lot of destruction within the country and is making politically making the country one of the most Islamophobic nations in the world, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. And with Allah, we seek refuge and His aid. On that note, Ameen indeed. Allahumma Ameen. On that note, we will conclude, and it's been very insightful, very engaging, fascinating in part as well, to speak to Ustad Adnan Rashid. I really appreciate your time and your effort. We finally got to lock this down.
Thank you so much. Thank you. God bless you. Thank you for having me, and you asked me some very important questions. We need to have these discussions more and more to raise awareness of our history in the Indian subcontinent, religiously and politically, and also what's happening today. So we need to connect our history with India and see a solution, find a solution to the current situation. And hopefully we will have those intellectuals and thinkers and mufakireen who will come forward and they will give us solutions, inshallah, to these problems. Let's say today we highlighted a lot of issues, and I want people to think of solutions that are intelligent, that are legal, that are practical. And inshallah, once we start working towards them, the situation can change. It may take 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, who knows? Okay, to do away with the poison of Islamophobia, it might take us a generation, but no problem. Let's do it. Let's start the work. And inshallah, Allah will help us, inshallah. Sure. As they say in Urdu, himmat-e marna, madad-e khuda. So if you basically get up and, if you, as they say, you know, if you want to do something, Allah will help you, inshallah.
Inshallah. And again, thank you. The pleasure is mine. And with that, we end the broadcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.